Hello and welcome. If you're listening to this, then you are now involved in our Greek class. For those of you who are listening online, maybe you're someone who is taking the class in person, but you want to refresh. And so these online modules will be a way for you to gain some more information that maybe wasn't in the class, because this will be purely lecture. Maybe this will be an opportunity for you to refresh yourself, to gain some more insight, to get some extra practice with some help. Or maybe you just, like me, love the sound of my voice. And this is the greatest good that you can have in your life is to listen to the sound of my voice. Whatever the reason is, I'm glad you're here. For some of you, you may not be able to make it to our class periods, but you still are interested in learning New Testament Greek. And so this is a way for you to get content that will help you as you study through the material, whether you've purchased curriculum or whether you're using the curriculum that I am creating. Whatever curricula you're using, I'm happy that you're here, and I hope that these lessons will be helpful. Today, this is the very first lesson in the series, and so there's going to be a little more information that maybe isn't directly involved in learning Greek, but these are important pieces of information that will allow us to lay the foundation for what you're going to learn later. So we will get to the actual lesson part, the first lesson of the class, but that will be coming a little bit later. First, we have some preliminary things to go through. So first of all, the question is, why? Why study New Testament Greek? I mean, there are so many things that you could study. There are an endless number of things that you could study, profitable things that would be good uses of your time. Why? Well, perhaps you're a pastor and you want to better know and better understand the Word of God. You want to be able to more perfectly teach and preach God's Word. That's a great reason. Maybe you're a layperson and you just want to know God's Word more fully for yourself, and maybe whatever teaching you do as teaching a Bible study or maybe leading Sunday school, you want to have more knowledge for yourself. Perhaps you're just an interested person in literature and poetry, and being able to read some of the greatest writing ever written in its original language is something that appeals to you. Or perhaps you're just bored and you want a hobby. That's a totally legitimate reason. I'm currently studying Latin as a hobby. Nobody's making me study Latin. I just want to because I like languages and it's fun for me. So why ever you're here, whatever your reason for being here, we're glad you're here. And I hope that these lessons will be helpful. So we've talked about why. The next question is not only why we're going to learn New Testament Greek, but how we're going to learn New Testament Greek. We need to talk a little bit about methodology. Now, there are basically two methodologies for language learning, especially dead language learning, because New Testament Greek is a dead language. It's in the continuum of the Greek languages, and if you went and you showed up speaking New Testament Greek in a Greek-speaking place, they would be able to understand you, but you probably wouldn't be able to understand them, and you would seem kind of weird to them. Your Greek would sound a little bit off. But it is a dead language, but it's on that continuum. It's a dead language in the same way that maybe early modern English, or maybe Middle English is a dead language. So, anyways, we have the question of how we're going to learn. Like I said, there are basically two approaches. The first approach is what I like to call the crash diet approach. And the crash diet approach is you take your grammar, whatever grammar you have. Maybe you're in this class, and because I've recommended Gatchell's elementary school grammar, maybe you're using that one. Or maybe you've gone for a more collegiate way. Maybe you're going with Mounts or Croy. Maybe you're weird and you've gone with, you know, one of the other ones. I can't say what grammar you have, but depending on what grammar you're using and what curriculum you're following, there are going to be two approaches. The first approach is to learn every single thing you can and drill it into your memory and make sure that you totally memorize and have the facts down pat. That's the first approach. And it's kind of like a crash diet approach. We could spend a couple weeks on the principles of pronunciation, of accentuation, of syllabification, of how we write the language. We could spend a long time doing that, and you would learn a lot, and it would be profitable. But the problem is that doing that isn't really encouraging. It's like a crash diet approach, where you might be doing an awful lot, and it might all be good stuff, but if you don't see practical results that you can use and that encourage you, it's really hard to stick with it. What I prefer is more of a healthy living approach, an approach where we look at the language and we want to use it. The goal of this class, as I hope was implied in the why section that we just finished, the goal of this class is for you to be able to confidently interact with the biblical text. Let me say that again. The goal is for you to confidently interact with the biblical text. The goal is not for you to be able to memorize a bunch of charts. There will be chart memorization because I believe in chart memorization, especially with a dead language. You have to understand your morphology. You have to know how to conjugate your verbs. You have to know how to decline your nouns and your adjectives. You need to know your vocab. Memorization is a part of this. But my philosophy is I want to give you as little of those things as possible so that you get actively working with the Bible. The most wonderful thing about learning New Testament Greek is when you sit there and you're struggling and it's like, I just can't get this. And then you look at a verse of Scripture and you translate it perfectly and you understand it. And then you get those verses where you suddenly see this truth that English doesn't convey. And the light bulb goes off and you're like, oh my word, this is so wonderful. This is a good use of my time. I'm so glad that I'm doing this. So that's what I'm hoping that we will get, is by skipping some of the things to come back to them later, we will gain a knowledge and an appreciation for the language that will be sufficient for us to interact with the language. I want you translating and working with the biblical text from week one. We will work with the biblical text this week. Okay? My goal is for you to be working with the biblical text always and to gain confidence in it. So the crash diet approach is learn everything about everything, and really just cram your head full of a lot of extraneous knowledge that is useful and it's good, but maybe you wouldn't need to learn until you've studied the language for 3 or 4 years. The important thing for me is not that you learn everything about everything. The important thing for me is that you gain confidence in interacting with the biblical text. That's the most important thing. And ultimately, my goal is at the end of a year, this is designed to be a one-year course, at the end of 1 year, by next February, you should be able to read, with limited helps, read the Gospel of John. You should be able to read through John's Gospel with only having some vocabulary helps. And that's a goal, and it's an ambitious goal, but it's a doable goal. It's something that's very possible. John is the easiest of the writings, especially the easiest of the major writings of the New Testament. And it's quite doable in 1 year to be able to read through it with limited vocabulary helps. So we've talked about why we're studying. That's really up to you to determine why you're studying. How we're studying, we're studying with this healthy living approach where we're not crash dieting. I'm only going to teach you what I think is necessary for you at that point to be able to confidently interact with the text. And we're going to have to retrace our steps. That's one of the downsides of the healthy living approach, is, you know, maybe sometime much later, we're going to have to go back to things, and you're going to say, wait, Luke, I thought you said this was the way it was. And I'll say, well, that was all you needed to know for now, but let me correct that. I gave you an oversimplification. So a healthy living approach, it does require some retracing of steps, but it helps you get into the Bible sooner. Lastly, as far as these preliminaries go, is what are we going to learn? What are we going to learn? Now, I keep saying New Testament Greek. Well, New Testament Greek is Koine Greek. Koine Greek. Now, delicious water. Greek can be divided into a couple of different stages. Five stages, according to Dr. Wallace and his intermediate grammar, which, by the way, if you are a student who, by the time we get through this first year, if you are really interested in continuing your Greek knowledge, I will offer all sorts of extra literature that might help you, extra resources. An invaluable resource for the serious New Testament Bible student is Dr. Wallace's Exegetical Syntax of the New Testament. It is an irreplaceable and invaluable document. It's quite long, and it takes some time to get through it, but it's very worth the money. I will drop names in the class for different resources that if you go to First Brethren, of course, you can borrow these, or at least I can print stuff off for you from these things. But if you're a serious student of the New Testament, some of these things are just kind of stuff you have to have. If you're not a serious student and you just want to read, that's okay too. But if you're a serious student and you're getting beyond the basics, then really, Exegetical Syntax of the New Testament by Dr. Dan Wallace from Dallas Theological Seminary. Invaluable, irreplaceable document. But according to Dr. Wallace, there are five stages of the Greek language. There is the pre-Homeric stage, the age of the dialects or the classical era. There is the Koine Greek period. That's what we're talking about today, is the Koine period. And then there was Byzantine or medieval Greek, and then there is modern Greek. There are two kinds of modern Greek, by the way. There's the literary language, or a friend of mine who lived in Greece for a long time called it newspaper Greek. And then there's the mataki, and the mataki is actually spelled demotic, but the modern D and the delta in modern Greek is pronounced like the Anglo-Saxon letter F, so it pronounces like V, like the mataki. A voiced dental fricative is kind of the fancy way of saying that. But, so we have, like I said, we've got five stages of Greek. Modern Greek is kind of divided into two kinds. There's literary Greek, or newspaper Greek, as some people have called it, and there's the mataki. Looking back at the period we want to study, we want to study Koine Greek. Koine Greek is this Greek that develops in this fascinating period in world history. It's 330 BC to 330 AD is how Dr. Wallace defines it. And Koine is the world language. Koine means common. It doesn't necessarily mean that this is the language spoken by the common man. That's a misconception. Koine means that it was the common form of Greek that was spoken across Greece, across Hellas and the Hellenistic parts of the world, as well as the rest of the world. So Alexander the Great, you want to know a little bit of history? So where does this Koine Greek come from? Why was everybody around the world speaking about this? Well, the story really begins a long time ago with the Greek wars between Persia and Greece, and there was the Hellenic League and Philip of Macedon. But really, the key to the story is Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great comes on the scene. He conquers the Mediterranean world. He weeps that there were no more places to conquer, and then he dies. So Alexander dies, but everywhere he's gone, he's spread Hellenistic culture. He's spread Greek culture, and with the culture, he's also spread the language. Now, the rest of the Mediterranean world is going to be divided amongst his generals. Classically, we view this as his four great generals who take over the rest of the world. Of the Bible's interest are the two groups, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, and those are the ones that the Bible focuses on, especially in the book of Daniel. But for our purposes linguistically, we're interested in all of them. So the known world is being run by these Greek-speaking people, and they spread the Greek language. And actually, there's a lot of advantage to this if you think about it. You know, the ancient world was very tribal, very divided, and the use of Greek as a trade language, the use of Greek as this means of communication across people groups and across borders is really useful, and it allows for an advance in culture and technology. If you think about it this way. Let's say you live in Damascus, right? So you're this Syrian who grew up speaking Aramaic. OK, Okay, but maybe you also sell pigs, and you sell pigs to the Roman army. Well, maybe you have to deal with the Roman quartermaster when you sell your hogs. Well, you're a Damascene who speaks Aramaic, and maybe that Roman quartermaster was from Gaul. So maybe he speaks some kind of Gallic Celtic language, as well as enough Latin to be a commander in the Roman army. But what are you going to speak? How do you have a common language? Well, because there was Koine Greek, because there was this common language of Greek, everybody is able to interact. But here's the rub. This Gallic centurion or quartermaster, Greek is a third language for him. For you, Greek is your second language. So when you communicate between the two of you, you're not going to be communicating in the fanciest, most technical, formal kind of Greek. You're going to be using a functional language because function is going to be the most important part. You need to know how many hogs he wants. He needs to know how much you want to be paid for your hogs. It's a transactional kind of language. And so what happens is that Greek, at least the form of Greek that was spread around the world, gets accommodated. It accommodates the needs of the users. And so the language becomes different. It's different from this Proto-Hellenic Greek and this pre-Homeric Greek, and it's different from the dialectical or the classical Greek. When we think of Greek, a classical Greek, we think of Attic Greek or Athenian Greek, and we think of this very high literary form of Greek, but there were other forms of Greek that were spoken at that time. What happens under Philip of Macedon and Alexander the Great and under the united Hellas is all of these different linguistic unique features begin to kind of have their rough edges rubbed off. And that's what happens then when Greek becomes a world language, is all of these things that are really difficult to understand that are unique to Greek, they begin to be lost. And people who maybe you're an Aramaic speaker, or maybe you're a native Hebrew speaker, or maybe you speak a Celtic language, or maybe your native language is Latin. What you're going to do is you're going to take Greek and you're going to make it work for you. You're going to take the language that was given to you and features that are either too difficult to understand because they're so different from what you've used, or they're not useful for your everyday life, you're going to jettison those. And what you're going to have is this functional language, which is not classical Greek. It's not classical Greek at all. But now it's become something different. It's Koine. Maybe it's Hebraic Greek, or maybe it's Aramaic Greek, or maybe it's Farsic Greek, or maybe it's Gallic Greek, or Latinic Greek. You've got these different forms of Greek that spread up, but across the board, it's kind of this kind of homogenous thing. What happens in Koine is the language is homogenized. The rough edges are banged off. Some of the more technical, more precise things about Greek are lost, but the language becomes a world language. Now, I want to say something really quickly here about the study of language, and forgive me for going a little off script here. But a lot of people view that as bad. There are people who are language purists who believe that people need to accommodate language. I disagree. I think that that's a fundamentally flawed view. People don't accommodate languages. Languages accommodate people. People have created language, depending on what your philosophy of language is. God invented language, whatever. But people use language to accommodate their daily lives, right? Language is a tool. Now, it's a great tool. It's a beautiful tool. It's a wonderful tool. It's a tool that has beauty and poetry and art. But it's ultimately a means of communication. It is functional at its core. And to be functional, it has to accommodate people's uses. Languages change. That's not a bad thing. Languages change. And what we've seen is that when languages try to stiffen and resist change, they stiffen so that they fossilize. That's how languages become dead. The only languages that don't change are dead languages, and even that isn't true, because even dead languages change a little bit. But that's what we see in Latin. Latin is a dead language now, because people don't speak language, and it doesn't have to meet the changing needs of the people. It doesn't have to meet changing forms of speech. So Latin has become fossilized, and we can easily look at the different periods of Latin. But Greek is a living language. Greek has continued to move on. Now, you could say that maybe Latin isn't a dead language because it morphed into Italian and Spanish and French and etc., but okay, that neither here nor there. The point is that languages accommodate people. People do not accommodate languages. Languages need to function, and to function, they need to be able to change. They need to be able to meet the needs of the people. If you want something like a French academy, where, you know, we're going to keep the language pure and we're not going to change it, that's not really the way forward. We need to recognize, as we study language, that languages change, and languages meet the needs of the people. And if we understand that, then especially if you do any, if as we continue to study, you're going to look at the language and you're going to say, wow, like Luke writes really differently from John. And the writer of the Hebrews writes really differently from Matthew. And Peter writes differently from all of them. Yeah, they do. They write very differently because a lot of them had different backgrounds. When we look at the New Testament itself, when we look at the Bible itself, we see that there are a lot of different styles of Greek here within just the Bible. Just within the Scripture, there are different forms of Greek. Now, of course, you have what would be called maybe Hebraic Greek, which is this form of Greek which is what you would speak if you were a Hebrew. If Hebrew was your native language, you would be speaking this language. If you're maybe Luke, maybe if you have a high formal education, then you're going to have this very high, almost stilted form of language. You have this neoclassical, is the term that's often used, this neoclassical form of Greek. If you have kind of in the middle, maybe you have a great education, but you don't have this stilted language, then maybe you're going to have maybe more of a conversational tone. There are basically three styles of Greek that we can identify in the Greek New Testament. There is Semitic or vulgar. Semitic is another word for Hebraic. And this would be, according to Dr. Wallace, he classifies Revelation, Mark, John, and 1 through 3 John and 2 Peter as Semitic or vulgar. Vulgar doesn't mean crass or perverse. Vulgar simply means used by the people. We have conversational Greek, which is most of Paul and Matthew. And then we have literary koine, which would be Hebrews, Luke, Acts, James, the pastoral letters of Paul, 1 Peter, and Jude. So somebody asks, why are 1 Peter and 2 Peter on opposite ends of the spectrum? The answer is there are different theories. I believe that Peter used an amanuensis, which is a fancy word for a secretary slash ghostwriter that was common in the ancient world, and he used one that Paul used also. So there are some comparisons that people make between 2 Peter and Paul's writings. Well, that's why, because they most likely used the exact same amanuensis. So those are the forms of Greek there are. Now, we've gotten through this in less than half an hour, which is much better than I actually thought we were going to do. Delicious water. So let's get down to it, shall we? We've talked about why we're learning. Why are we learning? You all have your own motivations. We've talked about how we're learning. We're taking the healthy living approach to studying Greek. We talked about our goal of learning. Our goal is by the end of the year to be able to confidently read through the Gospel of John with limited vocabulary helps. And we've talked about what we're learning. We're learning Koine Greek. So the question becomes, all right, well, let's get started. Why can't we start now? Well, the answer is we can start now, and we shall start now. You should have with you, and it should be linked in this page, a first lesson. The first lesson should be in front of you. I hope you have it in front of you or at least on your computer. I would recommend either printing it out or having a notebook where you can write these things out for yourself. And today we're going to begin with the alphabet. We're going to look at some blends blends or consonant blends. We're going to look at some diphthongs. Diphthongs is just a fancy word for when two vowels come together, and instead of having two distinct vowel sounds, they have they make one sound. And then we're going to look at diacritical marks or accent marks. And then we're going to practice some reading. So, have your text in front of you, and we're going to learn the alphabet today. Alphabet. So, it begins with alpha. 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 And you'll notice that I have put in capital letters the letter that you need to pronounce so that you know which is the important part. So with alpha, there's a capital A after the F, and that tells you that the alpha in Koine Greek is pronounced like the A in father. I use the Erasmian pronunciation. The Erasmian pronunciation is the pronunciation described by Erasmus of Rotterdam, who was a 16th century humanistic scholar. And if you use Erasmian pronunciation, you are going to use, to the best of our knowledge, what Koine Greek sounded like. You are going to sound like what the writers of the Greek New Testament would have sounded like. And there are a couple good reasons for this. First of all, simply for accuracy's sake, so that you actually sound, you can hear it, it's what it sounded like. So knowing what it sounded like and reading it that way is important. You also want to know not only what it sounded like accurately, but you want to study it so that you can catch plays on words, you can catch consonants and alliteration, you can find assonance, you can find these different literary features in the text, and that's much easier to do if you can pronounce it correctly. A third reason is for text critical reasons. We'll talk about that much later in the future, but text critical reasons. And fourthly, it can help you with your spelling and your vocab. We'll talk about this in just a little bit when we get to the letter when we get to Omicron, we'll get to that. But suffice to say that modern Greek has taken basically all the vowels and turned them into one letter. The letter eta, which they pronounce eta, and all of the Greek vowels are basically the same sound. And then a lot of the other letters have changed. Beta or beta has become vita. Vita, the B has become a V sound, a V sound. So, pronunciation has changed, and having accurate pronunciation works. Now, maybe you're also wondering, well, Luke, why do I need to know how to pronounce it at all? All I need to do is learn how to read it. Well, that's true in a technical sense, but if you're able to read it with confidence and actually make the sounds, it's going to help you in your reading. There's something called subvocalization, which happens when you read with your eyes. When you read with your eyes. Of course you read with your eyes. When you read without saying something. If you're simply reading and you're trying to read fast, subvocalization is where you hear the word in your head, but you don't actually say it out loud. You can read so fast that you don't subvocalize, where that's skimming, is where you just like look at things and you don't actually say the word in your head. But if you can say it correctly, if you can pronounce it correctly, if you know the correct pronunciation, it's going to make subvocalization easier. So we use the Erasmian pronunciation. You should know how to pronounce the words, and you should have confidence doing so. More than anything, if you're going to discuss this with somebody else, you want to sound like you know what you're talking about. So maybe I'm going to shame you into knowing how to pronounce it. But anyways, we must keep moving on. So our pronunciation, alpha, ah, father, alpha, beta, ba, boy, beta, gamma, g, girl, gamma, delta, d, dog, delta, epsilon, e, egg, epsilon, zeta, z, zoo, zeta, eta, a, cake, eta, theta, thing, theta, iota, e, creep, iota, kappa, k, king, kappa, lambda, l, Luke, lambda, mu, moo, nu, new, new. Xi, x, ax, xi. Omicron, ah, pot, Omicron. Okay, I told you I would pause right here. Omicron and alpha in Ohio, which is where we live, the Ohio dialect of English, are indistinguishable sounds. And you say, oh, well, no, they're different. No, they're not. If you say, try to say, not my father, in the dialect of Midwestern English that we sound, the O sound in not and the A sound in father are exactly the same. Not my father. You know, like Luke Skywalker, you're not my father, it's not true, it can't be true. Okay, well, we pronounce those letters the same way. Now, in other parts of America, they are pronounced differently, and you kind of have to move your tongue down in your mouth to say, ah, ah, Omicron, Omicron, ah, pot, cot, hot, right? Not hot, pot, cot, it's ought. It's lower in your throat. Now, you say, well, why should I care? Well, for this reason, it will help you with your spelling. It'll help you spell things correctly. It will help you spell things where there's maybe an option of, if you pronounce alpha and omicron the same way, then how do you know which is which if you just hear a word and you want to know how to spell it? It will help you with your subvocalization. It will help you with your memory work. Knowing all of these sounds are distinct is helpful. To me, it was anyways. Another word on omicron. There is considerable evidence that by the time of Koine Greek, the letter omega and omicron, like little o and omega, mega, big O, that omicron and omega were both pronounced with the long O sound of O and not ah. So you have every right to pronounce logos as logos and not logos. You can say hologos and not halagos. You have every right to pronounce it whichever way you want. I think both are perfectly legitimate. For my purposes, again, to be able to distinguish them for spelling and for vocab purposes and for sub-vocalization, I think that having a different pronunciation is good. But actually, if you want to be more technically accurate, it's probably more technically accurate to say logos rather than logos. But, you know, hey, to each his own. We will continue with the alphabet. P, not pi, P, as in puh, P, P. Ro, row. Sigma, sigma. Now, a quick note on sigma. If you look, there are three letters here. The first one is the capital or uncial sigma. And then you have two of these lowercase forms, the minuscule forms. The one that looks like a circle with a hat on it, or maybe somebody who's got an emo flop in the wind, that is sigma that's used everywhere but the last letter of a word. The other sigma, which is this curlicue sigma, which looks like a C with a tail on it, that is the final sigma. That's used at the end of the word. We'll talk about why we have final sigmas and stuff in just a little bit. Tau, t, taters, tau. Upsilon, upsilon. Phi, f, phi. Chi, ch, bach, chi. Psi, oops, ps, oops, psi. Omega, O, no, omega. Okay, so that's our Greek alphabet, Now, you can, pronunciation shouldn't take you that long to master. Most of it is the same, a little bit of vowel difference, but the Greek alphabet is a pretty easy one to learn. There is an alphabet song that I use for the Greek alphabet, and it involves one word, one Greek word that is not in the alphabet itself, and that is the word chi, which means and. So the alphabet song I use for Greek is this, and I'll sing it slowly, and then I'll sing it a little bit faster. So, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon, zeta, eta, theta, iota, kappa, lambda, mu, nu, xi, omicron, pi, rho, sigma, tau, upsilon, phi, chi, chi, psi, chi, omega. It kind of works to the tune of Alouetta. Let me do it again. Alpha, beta, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon, zeta, eta, theta, iota, kappa, lambda, mu, nu, xi, omicron, pi, rho, sigma, tau, upsilon, phi, chi, chi, psi, chi, omega. So you can do it really fast. You can do alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon. You know, you can do it really fast if you want. But if you want a good rhythm to learn, I would recommend using Alouette. I haven't found a way to use the alphabet song. I can do the alphabet song in English and Hebrew and, you know, other languages, but it doesn't seem to work with Greek. I haven't found a good way to make it work for Greek. But next, we want to look at some special letter blends that are important. The first ones we want to look at are these combinations with gamma. You'll notice here that I've got gamma gamma, gamma kappa, gamma xi, and gamma chi. Whenever you see these together, gamma gamma makes the ng sound, like I like to sing a song for Kim Basinger. You have the ng song, okay? So that's why if you see the word angelos, which is the word angel, or euangelion, which is gospel, it's going to look like agelos or euangelion. It's because... Evangelion, by the way, is gospel or evangel. It's anyways, that's another story. But what happens is that GG or gamma gamma makes the ing sound. Now, if you go gamma kappa, it makes ink, ink. So you make the ing sound, and then you add the kappa to it. Gamma xi makes the inks sound. So it makes gamma gamma, and then the x sound. Gamma chi, can you take a wild guess what it does? Can you make that sound? Yep. Ng-ch, ng-ch. So it makes gamma gamma, and then ch. So whenever you see gamma gamma, gamma kappa, gamma xi, gamma chi, it makes the ing sound, and then you add whatever those other letters are. So kappa, xi, or chi. The other special letter or letter blend that's important is rho. At the beginning of a word, rho is going to have what's called a rough breathing mark. It's essentially the letter H. So you get H plus R, and it makes rho. So we get this word with, like, rhea, which means a flow, which is where we get the word diarrhea from, rhea, or the word rhema, which is another word for word, right? So that only happens at the beginning of a letter. If you see R at the beginning, rho at the beginning of a word in Greek, it's going to have the rough breathing mark, and it's going to be rho, pronounced like that. Now we need to look at our diphthongs. So if you look here, we have alpha iota, which is pronounced I. We have epsilon iota, which is pronounced A. We have omicron iota, which is pronounced oi. Alpha upsilon, which is au. Epsilon upsilon, u. Omicron upsilon, oo. Okay, so we have these diphthongs. We have I, A, oi, ow, u, oo, oo. Okay, so those are our diphthong sounds. I, A, oi, ow, u, oo. And lastly, we want to look at, as far as our accents, we want to look at our diacritical marks. Now, diacritical marks are accents, and these are a little bit important to know. This is going to take a little bit of time to go into, but just bear with me. It will not be that hard. The rough breathing mark and the soft breathing mark. First is the soft breathing mark. That's the quotation mark or the apostrophe that points to the left. That one is soft. That gets no pronunciation at all. The one that points to the right, that gets pronounced as an H. That's called the rough breathing mark. Now, why do they have breathing marks? They have breathing marks because originally Greek was written, like most languages, with no spaces between the letters at all. There were no spaces between the letters. It was called scriptio continua. It means you continually write. So to know where words began and ended, they use these accents. And they used other keys like a final sigma and other things in the language to help you know where the beginning of a word was. So accents, we have the soft breathing mark and the rough breathing mark. The soft breathing mark is not pronounced, and The rough breathing mark is pronounced as the letter H. We have the accent grave, which is a falling intonation accent, but that tells you that that's the syllable that's accented. That's the accented syllable. Whatever gets the accent, that is the pronounced accented syllable. So if you have an accent grave, the one that's pointing to the right, that's a falling intonation. The one that's pointing to the left is a rising intonation. That's an accent aigu or an acute accent. And the one that kind of looks like a Spanish tilde right there, most of the time people just make an arch. They don't, but this font has made it a tilde. That's called an accent circumflex, and that has rising and falling intonation. Sometimes it'll be a caret also. It just depends on what your font does. So you have your five basic. There are more, but these are your five most basic ones that you need to know. So today we're going to finish with some reading for practice. I am going to read. I want you to try to follow along. I know that this is probably going to be impossible, but I want you to follow along and just hear the language a little bit and get an idea of what's going on. So, reading for practice, and this is something you should do on your own as well. Energe en hologos, kai hologos en proston theon, kai theos ein hologos. Houtos ein en arche proston theon, panta diautu egeneto, kai choris autu egeneto ude hen, ho gegonen en auto zoe ein, kai het zoe en tos fos ton anthropon, kai to fos en to escotia faene, kai escotia auto catalaben, egeneto anthropos apostelamenos. Para Theo, onoma autu Ioannes, hutos elthen es marturion, marturese peritu photos, hina pantes pistuos sin diautu, uc en ekenos tofos al hina marturese peritu photos, en tofos to alethinon, ho fotidze panta anthropon erchomenon eston cosmon, en to cosmo en, kai ho cosmos di autu egeneto, kai ho cosmos auton uc egno, esta idia elthen, kai hoi oidioi auton u paralabon, hosoi de elaben auton, edoken autois exusion technotheo genestae tois pistiosin eston anom autu, hoe de uc ex hamation ude ec thalamatos sacros ude ec thalamatos andros al ec theu egenethesan kai hologos sarx egeneto kai eskenosen en hemin kai etheas sametha ten doxon autu doxan hos monogonos para patros pleres charitos kai elethies Ιωάννος μαρτύρε περί αυτού, καί και κράγεν λέγον, χούτος εν χον επαν, χω οπίζω μου ερχόμενος εν πρόσθεν μου γεγόνεν, χωτι πρώτος μου εν, χωτι εκ του πληρώματος αυτού, εμές πάντες αλαμπόμεν, καί χάριν αντι χάριτος, χωτι χωνόμος δημοσιοέως εδόθε. Εχάρις καὶ ἐλέθεια δια Ιησού Χριστού αγένετο. Θεόν ούδες εωράκεν ποπότε. Μονόγενες Θεός, χωόν εσ τον κόλπον του πάτρος εκένος εξ εγεσάτο. So, that was a little bit of pronunciation, and I've made mistakes. I've made mistakes because I was, you know, I don't read Greek out loud a lot. I can read it perfectly in my head, but when I start talking, my tongue falls all over itself. So, as you've noticed, I made some mistakes. But the more we read out loud, the more we practice, the better we're going to get at our language. So if you noticed, you're like, oh, wait, Luke, I thought you said this was the thing. Oh, yeah, I probably made a lot of mistakes reading. I don't often, sometimes accents change in Greek, and sometimes I miss the changes in the accents. So if you found mistakes with what I read, you're probably right. I made some mistakes. But I hope that this has been a useful introduction, and so what I would recommend until next week's lesson is for you to to read and know your alphabet, write it as often as you can, memorize it, get your pronunciation right, and practice reading out loud. If people think you look like a weirdo, that's okay. That's okay. You'll live. But practice reading out loud. Practice making your tongue and your mouth make these noises. Practice your Greek. 5, 10 minutes a day is really all that's necessary right now. You work 5, 10 minutes a day, and then by next week, hopefully, we'll have the alphabet down pat. You'll have the pronunciations down pat. You will know your diphthongs and your blends, and you'll be able to do some basic reading. And next week, we're going to jump in. We're going to jump right in to some vocab and learning how to use the verb. So this is going to be exciting. Next week is going to be an exciting, exciting lesson. So I appreciate your time, and I pray that God would bless you and your studies. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.